Chapter 72. Of cloth opposite, and shone like little lamps suspended there. Troy, on peeping from his dressing tent through a slit for a reconnoiter before entering, saw his unconscious wife on high before him as described, sitting as queen of the tournament. He started back in utter confusion, for although his disguise effectually concealed his personality, he instantly felt that she would be sure to recognize his voice. He had several times during the day thought of the possibility of some Weatherbury person or other appearing and recognizing him, but he had taken the risk carelessly. "If they see me, let them," he had said. But here was Bathsheba in her own person, and the reality of the scene was so much intenser than any of his prefigurings that he felt he had not half enough considered the point. She looked so charming and fair that his cool mood about Weatherbury people was changed. He had not expected her to exercise this power over him in the twinkling of an eye. Should he go on and care nothing? He could not bring himself to do that. Beyond a politic wish to remain unknown, there suddenly arose in him now a sense of shame at the possibility that his attractive young wife, who already despised him, should despise him more by discovering him in so mean a condition after so long a time. He actually blushed at the thought, and was vexed beyond measure that his sentiments of dislike towards Weatherbury should have led him to dally about the country in this way. But Troy was never more clever than when absolutely at his wit's end. He hastily thrust aside the curtain dividing his own little dressing space from that of the manager and proprietor, who now appeared as the individual called Tom King as far down as his waist, and as the aforesaid respectable manager thence to his toes. "Here's the devil to pay," said Troy. "How's that?" "Why, there's a blackguard creditor in the tent I don't want to see, who'll discover me and nab me as sure as Satan if I open my mouth. What's to be done?" "You must appear now, I think." "I can't. But the play must proceed. Do you give out that Turpin has got a bad cold, and can't speak his part, but that he'll perform it just the same without speaking?" The proprietor shook his head. "Anyhow, play or no play, I won't open my mouth," said Troy, firmly. "Very well, then let me see. I tell you how we'll manage," said the other, who perhaps felt it would be extremely awkward to offend his leading man just at this time. I won't tell him anything about your keeping silence. Go on with the piece and say nothing, doing what you can by a judicious wink now and then, and a few indomitable nods in the heroic places, you know. They'll never find out that the speeches are omitted." This seemed feasible enough, for Turpin's speeches were not many or long, the fascination of the piece lying entirely in the action, and accordingly the play began, and at the appointed time Black Bess leapt into the grassy circle amid the plaudits of the spectators. At the turnpike scene, where Bess and Turpin are hotly pursued at midnight by the officers, and half-awake gatekeeper in his tasseled nightcap denies that any horseman has passed, Coggan uttered a broad-chested "well done," which could be heard all over the fair above the bleeding, and Poorgrass smiled delightedly with a nice sense of dramatic contrast between our hero, who coolly leaps the gate, and halting justice in the form of his enemies, who must needs pull up cumbersomely and wait to be let through. At the death of Tom King, he could not refrain from seizing Coggan by the hand, and whispering, with tears in his eyes, "Of course he's not really shot, Jan only seemingly." And when the last sad scene came on, and the body of the gallant and faithful Bess had to be carried out on a shutter by 12 volunteers from among the spectators, nothing could restrain Poorgrass from lending a hand, exclaiming, as he asked Jan to join him, "'Twill be something to tell of at Warren's in future years, Jan, and hand down to our children." For many a year in Weatherbury, Joseph told, with the air of a man who had had experiences in his time, that he touched with his own hand the hoof of Bess as she lay upon the board upon his shoulder. If, as some thinkers hold, immortality consists in being enshrined in others' memories, then did Black Bess become immortal that day if she never had done so before? Meanwhile, Troy had added a few touches to his ordinary makeup for the character, the more effectually to disguise himself, and though he had felt faint qualms on first entering, the metamorphosis effected by Judica Owsley ironing his face with a wire rendered him safe from the eyes of Bathsheba and her men. Nevertheless, he was relieved when it was got through. There a second performance in the evening, and the tent was lighted up. Troy had taken his part very quietly this time, venturing to introduce a few speeches on occasion, and was just concluding it when, whilst standing at the edge of the circle contiguous to the first row of spectators, he observed within a yard of him the eye of a man darted keenly into his side features. Troy hastily shifted his position, after having recognized in sworn enemy, who still hung about the outskirts of it. First Troy resolved to take no notice and abide by circumstances. That he had been recognized by this man was highly probable, yet there was room for a doubt. Then the great objection he had felt to allowing news of his proximity to precede him to Weatherbury in the event of his return, based on the feeling that knowledge of his present occupation would discredit him still further in his wife's eyes, returned in full force. Moreover, should he resolve not to return at all, a tale of his being alive and being in the neighborhood would be awkward, and he was anxious to acquire a knowledge of his wife's temporal affairs before deciding which to do. In this dilemma, Troy at once went out to reconnoiter. It occurred to him that to find Pennyways, and make a friend of him if possible, would be a very wise act. He had put on a thick beard borrowed from the establishment, and this he wandered about the fair field. It was now almost dark, and respectable people were getting their carts and gigs ready to go home. The largest refreshment booth in the fair was provided by an innkeeper from a neighboring town. This was considered an unexceptionable place for obtaining the necessary food and rest. Host Trencher, as he was jauntily called by the local newspaper, being a substantial man of high repute for catering through all the county round. The tent was divided into first and second class compartments, and at the end of the first class division was a yet further enclosure for the most exclusive, fenced off from the body of the tent by a luncheon bar, behind which the host himself stood bustling about in white apron and shirt sleeves, and looking as if he had never lived anywhere but under canvas all his life. In these penetralia were chairs and a table, which, on candles being lighted, made quite a cozy and luxurious show, with an urn, plated tea and coffee pots, china teacups, and plum cakes. Troy stood at the entrance to the booth, where a gypsy woman was frying pancakes over a little fire of sticks and selling them at a penny apiece, and looked over the heads of the people within. He could see nothing of Pennyways, but he soon discerned Bathsheba through an opening into the reserved space at the further end. Troy thereupon retreated, went round the tent into the darkness, and listened. He could hear Bathsheba's voice immediately inside the canvas. She was conversing with a man. A warmth overspread his face. Surely she was not so unprincipled as to flirt in the fair. He wondered if, then, she reckoned upon his death as an absolute certainty. To get at the root of the matter, Troy took a penknife from his pocket and softly made two little cuts crosswise in the cloth, which, by folding back the corners, left a hole the size of a wafer. Close to this, he placed his face, withdrawing it again in a movement of surprise, for his eye had been within 12 inches of the top of Bathsheba's head. LT was too near to be convenient. He made another hole a little to one side and lower down, in a shaded place beside her chair, from which it was easy and safe to survey her by looking horizontally. Troy took in the scene completely now. She was leaning back, sipping a cup of tea that she held in her hand, and the owner of the male voice was Boldwood, who had apparently just brought the cup to her, but Sheba, being in a negligent mood, leant so idly against the canvas that it was pressed to the shape of her shoulder, and she was, in fact, as good as in Troy's arms. and he was obliged to keep his breast carefully backward, that she might not feel its warmth through the cloth as he gazed in. Troy found unexpected chords of feeling to be stirred again within him as they had been stirred earlier in the day. She was handsome as ever, and she was his. It was some minutes before he could counteract his sudden wish to go in and claim her. Then he thought how the proud girl who had always looked down upon him, even whilst it was to love him, would hate him on discovering him to be a strolling player. Were he to make himself known, that chapter of his life must at all risks be kept forever from her, and from the Weatherbury people, or his name would be a byword throughout the parish. He would be nicknamed Erpin as long as he lived. Assuredly, before he could claim her, these few past months of his existence must be entirely blotted out. "Shall I get you another cup before you start, ma'am?" said Farmer Boldwood. "I thank you," said Bathsheba. "But I must be going at once. It was great neglect in that man to keep me waiting here till so late. I should have gone 2 hours ago, if it had not been for him. I had no idea of coming in here, but there's nothing so refreshing as a cup of tea, though I should never have got one, if you hadn't helped me." Troy scrutinized her cheek as lit by the candles, and watched each varying shade thereon, and the white shell-like sinuosities of her little ear. She took out her purse, and was insisting to Boldwood on paying for her tea for herself, when at this moment Pennyways entered the tent. Troy trembled. Here was his scheme for respectability endangered at once. He was about to leave his whole vestibule, attempt to follow Pennyways, and find out if the ex-bailiff had recognized him, when he was arrested by the conversation, and found he was too late. "Excuse me, ma'am," said Pennyways. "I've some private information for your ear alone. I cannot hear it now," she said, coldly. That Bathsheba could not endure this man was evident. In fact, he was continually coming to her with some tale or other, by which he might creep into favor at the expense of persons maligned. "I'll write it down," said Pennyways, confidently. He stooped over the table, pulled a leaf from a warped pocketbook, and wrote upon the paper, in a round hand, "Your husband is here. I've seen him. Who's the fool now?" This he folded small, and handed towards her. Bathsheba would not read it. She would not even put out her hand to take it. Pennyways then, with a laugh of derision, tossed it into her lap, and, turning away, left her. From the words and action of Pennyways, Troy, though he had not been able to see what the ex-bailiff wrote, had not a moment's doubt that the note referred to him. Nothing that he could think of could be done to check the exposure. "See, curse my luck," he whispered, and added imprecations which rustled in the gloom like a pestilent wind. Meanwhile, Boldwood said, taking up the note from her lap, "Don't you wish to read it, Mrs. Troy? If not, I'll destroy it." "Oh, well," said Bathsheba, carelessly, "perhaps it is unjust not to read it, but I can guess what it is about. He wants me to recommend him, or it is to tell me of some little scandal, or another connected with my work people. He's always doing that." Bathsheba held the note in her right hand. Boldwood handed towards her a plate of cut bread and butter, when, in order to take a slice, she put the note into her left hand, where she was still holding the purse, and then allowed her hand to drop beside her close to the canvas. The moment had come for saving his game, and Troy impulsively felt that he would play the card, for yet another time he looked at the fair hand, and saw the pink fingertips, and the blue veins of the wrist, encircled by a bracelet of coral chippings which she wore. How familiar it all was to him! Then, with the lightning action in which he was such an adept, he noiselessly slipped his hand under the bottom of the tent cloth, which was far from being pinned tightly down, lifted it a little way, keeping his eye to the hole, snatched the note from her fingers, dropped the canvas, and ran away in the gloom towards the bank and ditch, smiling at the scream of astonishment which burst from her. Troy then slid down on the outside of the rampart, hastened round in the bottom of the entrenchment to a distance of 100 yards, ascended again, and crossed boldly in a slow walk towards the front entrance of the tent. His object was now to get to Pennyways, and prevent a repetition of the announcement until such time as he should choose. Troy reached the tent door, and standing among the groups there gathered, looked anxiously for Pennyways, evidently not wishing to make himself prominent by inquiring for him. One or two men were speaking of a daring attempt that had just been made to rob a young lady by lifting the canvas of the tent beside her. It was supposed that the rogue had imagined a slip of paper which she held in her hand to be a banknote, for he had seized it and made off with it, leaving her purse behind. His chagrin and disappointment at discovering its worthlessness would be a good joke, it was said. However, the occurrence seemed to have become known to few, for it had not interrupted a fiddler, who had lately begun playing by the door of the tent, nor the four bowed old men with grim countenances and walking sticks in hand, who were dancing a Jormally's reel to the tune. Behind these stood Pennyways. Troy glided up to him, beckoned, and whispered a few words, and with a mutual glance of concurrence the two men went into the night together. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.